In 1893, the Chofetz Chaim got sick of it. For about a dozen years, as his biographer records it, rabbis, merchants, people who simply could not make it or stand the anti-Semitism in Europe, approached the Chofetz Chaim and said, "Mr. Rabbi Chofetz Chaim, what do you think about us resettling in the United States of America?" At first, the Chofetz Chaim, he was never very sanguine about it, but he tolerated it. But after a while, after hearing so many rumors of what was happening across the Atlantic, the Chofetz Chaim had decided that he had had enough. So he started to tell people, you know what, better to stay in Europe. And then, when he realized, you know what, because he was rather ensconced in Radin, I can reach much more people. After all, I'm the Chofetz Chaim, I publish a book. So he published two volumes of what's called Nidchei Yisrael, in which its sole purpose is to convince Am Yisrael not to move, not to emigrate from Europe to the United States. And so it is, there's an entire chapter in what is still the leading biography of the Chofetz Chaim, written by Rabbi Moshe Meir Yashar, and originally published in Yiddish in New York in 1937. And at the end of the chapter, and that's our business this evening, at the end of the chapter, he admits that perhaps the Chofetz Chaim might have been off slightly. While certainly neither Rabbi Yashar or the Chofetz Chaim before him would have countenanced the non-observance in the United States. Of course, there was non-observance everywhere, but it was acute in America. The Chofetz Chaim, perhaps at the very end of his life, he dies in 1933, he regretted some of the harsh language that he offered about the condition, the religious condition in America. So, Rabbi Yashar writes that if the Chofetz Chaim had charata, if he regretted it, then perhaps other people might have as well. So he writes first in Yiddish, but we'll look at it in Hebrew and in English. That's source one. Again, in 1937, everybody have a source sheet? There are actually two source sheets, but really you only need the one with all the different numerical sources. L'magenet leiv, nimnu hagdolim hamadhigim l'hachshir b'ofen ma'aseh. This was published, the Hebrew version, but it's exactly the same as the Yiddish, was published several decades later. And he writes that it is regrettable, magenet leiv, and nimnu, that the great leaders of Klal Yisrael prevented, that they refrained from legitimizing, not with the Chofetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, but another, not a Chofetz Chaim, but a Rab Chaim, what Asher Chaza Meirosh Gaon Hador, in that second level, the second in the white section. Rab Chaim Volozhin, Lifnei Lamala Memeya Shana. All of the rabbis, all of the elites, all of the leaders who portended absolute doom for the Jewish people in America, perhaps they might regret the consequences of their actions. Of course, this is written in 1937, so it would be far more regrettable, less than a decade later, but that they prevented, or they tried to stymie, the chazah, the vision of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin that he prophesied more than 100 years ago, Ki America tafoch l'America shel yahadut, because America would be transformed into the center, not just of anything, yahadut, of Judaism at its core, v'chiya Torah, and the Torah itself, timtza b'America, would find a host in the United States, et achsanita that it would become the center and it would become a major host of Torah in America, because, and he presumes apparently that you know this legend as well, because there would be, because it would be the last, the Achrona Shel Eser HaGoliot, it would be the 10th exile, Sha'ala La'avor Lefi HaMesorah. Because we have a Mesorah, says the biographer of the Chavetz Chaim, that there would be 10 exiles, there would be 10 stops along the way, according to Mesorah, according to our tradition. America would be the final place, the final center of Torah before Yemot HaMashiach. That is the vision of Rabbi Chaim of Vilna. Anybody know when Rabbi Chaim Vilna lived?
Hmm?
1820, 1821, I believe. There's a machlok as historians, but absolutely right. So he dies in that time. He lives in the age of Washington and Jefferson. This is the hinterland of all culture. Forget about Jewish culture. He's not talking, there's no Abraham Lincoln. There are no railroads. There's not even manifest destiny quite at this point. The supposition that Torah would travel to America. Anybody know how many Jews there were in America at this time?
Some.
Probably around 15 to 20,000 Jews in the United States at this time. There would be 150,000 at 1850 and also around the Civil War. There would be 1 million by the turn of the century, by 1900. There would be about 5 million, anywhere between 3 and 5, we're not exactly sure, around the year 1920. So the prophecy, so to speak, of Reb Chaim Vilna, and our business here isn't to test the veracity of whether this happened or not. I mean, I will contend, though, it did happen, so I guess I am testing it. But this is a major vision to suppose that in America, which was the boondocks of world culture. Now, of course, probably the most famous man alive in the previous generation was Benjamin Franklin, so I don't want to overstate it. But to suppose that entire civilization or culture would develop in the United States was no foregone conclusion whatsoever. So what does this have to do with religious science? What I want to test this evening is something that might sound, at least at first blush, counterintuitive to religious science. I want to look at a vision about America, but of course it leads to Yemot HaMashiach. The vision itself, and we'll look at perhaps the most authentic version that's been passed, that's been transmitted to us to this day, but the vision is that Torah will have 10 different centers, and then only when it achieves a station in each can we bring forth Mashiach. Well, is that so different at its core than from a religious Zionist mission? At its core, religious Zionism is a way to actively participate in bringing Yemot HaMashiach. That's not to say that revisionist Zionism, political Zionism, and social Zionism, I'm not talking about any of those particular pathways towards a Zionist vision. When we refer to religious Zionism, I have yet to see any author, any ideologue suggest that religious Zionism can be somehow decoupled from Yemot HaMashiach, from some sort of vision of this stage in our development and our history is bringing forth Mashiach. Well, for religious Zionists in America, the great challenge is, how do we justify and how do we grapple with the fact that we are both simultaneously American and we support a Zionist cause in Eretz Yisrael? The solution for so many alumni of Camp Moshe in the 1950s and 60s, of course, was not attention at all. Let's make Aliyah. But for many, many of us, it is attention. Therefore, America has to somehow find a place, become enveloped into our religious Zionism in some way, shape, form, whether that's philanthropy, whether that's your ability to vote for the President of the United States without an absentee ballot, however you wrap your Americanism into it, it's part of your religious Zionism. And what I want to look at this evening is not just the myth in itself. And by myth, I don't want to say that I'm going to debunk it, but it's a foundational story, as we'll find out for, of course, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, and we'll look at his language in just a little bit, but also it has become the foundational story in the yeshiva world in America. So take a look at the source sheet. The story was, so to speak, making its rounds. So if you look in source 2, a Rabbi Abba Zantz writes an article, short article, but an important one, in 1947, right after the Shoah. What is the article titled? Merkaz HaTorah V'Darko LaAmerika. To, again, in 1947, recognizing the cataclysm brought about by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, understanding in 1947 that Torah needs to be a center. Here is a rabbinic writer in actually a newspaper, a magazine, a monthly, not really a newspaper, but a magazine that comes out of Chicago, Hapardes. Zichroni, I recall, writes this author, Vihine, Rav Peretz, based in Deutsch. So he recalls a particular individual, a Talmud Chacham in Europe, Hanimtza Az, who was still in Europe, not at the end of World War II, but the beginning of World War I, in the city of Brisk, which looms large this evening. Patach v'amar midivrei Maran, he quotes the name of Yerucham Levavitz, Rav Shiva of Mir, b'shem ha-gaon Reb Chaim Mivolozhin, hu haya omer, asher b'kivta b'mashicha, tzricha Torah od liyod b'galuta ha-achrona ba-America. So again, he's recalling in 1947 that he heard much earlier that Torah would eventually be exiled, but somehow in a good way, to the United States of America. Ubi hizkir ha-gaon Reb Chaim, again, Reb Chaim V'lozhiner, what happened? Zot ga'ah v'bechia. Here's the romance in the story. The story goes that when Reb Chaim prophesied this, he let out this tremendous wail. He cried. B'yamim ahem, lo havinunu adayin pesher hadavar. We, in the early 19th century, I won't be able to pin down exactly when he delivered this nevuah, but nobody could have understood what it meant in this prophecy and why he cried. Gam ech v'ketzad tzera t'hilich hazeh, how this would transpire, masa lumdei ha-Torah la-America, how it would be that Torah would traverse the Atlantic and settle in the United States. Bram dvarim eila nichrotau ha-hetev b'leiv ha-shomeham. Now, of course, sadly, everybody quite realizes it's apparent how Torah came to America. V'shomano et ha-davar v'chadron t'mon. So, and he reflects very sadly that why did Reb Chaim go? Why? Let me ask you. Why does the writer suppose? He doesn't say it outright, but it's a thinly veiled romantic climax to this discussion. Why does he suppose that Reb Chaim V'lozhiner cried? He delivers this nevuah in front of some assemblage, and then he starts to weep. Why did he weep? Yes?
Maybe he foresaw the Holocaust.
Because somehow he foretold the travesty of 6 million Jews dying on Yidei HaNatzim Yimach Shem. Absolutely right. That is the supposition. That is why he would have cried.
Maybe he also actually read the Constitution, read the papers of the Founding Fathers, realized at that point there was no other country that I'm aware of that had a strict separation in the Constitution of state and church. And he realized...
Well, he would have to read the Bill of Rights then.
What?
He'd have to read the Bill of Rights too. But absolutely.
Separation and the establishment clause. You know, he just marked that. He read it, and he figured, and he read the Founding Fathers, and he said, you know what? At the end of the day, we have pogroms here, and they've established a country that, as you said, is not really much now. It's just the Atlantic seaboard, but There's something here that we have no place else, and that is the separation.
Interesting. And that was worth crying over, the First Amendment.
Yeah, see,
okay, that doesn't explain the crying and producing the Shoah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, he cried not because of the Shoah. He says, because he understood that the only way Jews would come to America, by and large, was because of the Shoah.
Interesting.
That's when Torah developed in America.
Either way, again, why Reb Chaim cried is a matter of dispute, but certainly I think this writer supposes that it has something to do. Remember, he's talking about, but the readers quite apparently understand in 1947 why they might have cried. Now, just to point out that those of us who are not familiar with the story should not feel too bad, because it's unclear to me how well known this tale, this nevuah, was even in Europe. So just this is a point of order, if you can flip, I'm sorry to make you flip back and forth. If you go to page 5, Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung, a famed Talmud Chacham in Canada, wrote a memoir about his experiences avoiding both the Nazis and the Soviets. He wrote a memoir called From a Nazi Veil of Tears. It's actually been translated quite wonderfully into English recently. But if you look, he makes an interesting error. If you look on page 236, where he records a story in Yiddish, you'll see that he misremembered a conversation he had with Reb Chaim Ozer shortly before he left, and he assumes that it's Reb Chaim Brisker. Well, that's a different Reb Chaim, that's Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. So the fact that somebody of Rabbi Hirschsprung's caliber would misremember, and this is a bit of conjecture, but I do want to point it out, is the fact that he's misremembering which Reb Chaim it was leads me to question how well known the story was in Europe. When it comes to America, however, the story, particularly in the yeshiva world, was not at all forgotten. So if you turn the page, you'll see, and thank you to Rabbi Moshe Kaladny of the Aguda Archives. An archivist is nothing without his or her archivist. You'll see this is actually quite a collector's item. The original, I can't imagine what it would fetch. But this is the autographed handwriting of Rav Aaron Cutler in April 1941. Rav Aaron Cutler had escaped Nazis through Shanghai and disembarked in San Francisco, spent about an instant in San Francisco, traveled by rail to Cincinnati, picked up the well-known Rabbi Eliezer Silver, marched to New York and stayed there forevermore. But for a brief moment, he was in San Francisco. Right? He was a warrior fan. And he delivered a speech. We have the autographed copy. Now, it's not the most legible handwriting, so if you go back to the front page, I've reproduced it for you in a readable font. Source 3. Motelet Aleinu. This is Rav Aaron Cutler. He prepares these remarks as he's being fingerprinted or something like that. He's about to disembark. He has his one page of notes, and he delivers this in front of a couple dozen, I imagine, Jews who are waiting for the great Rosh Hashiva of Klesk to come and touch down on American soil. And these are his remarks that have been preserved for us. Motelet aleinu achova. It is our obligation, declares Rav Aaron Cutler, la'asot kikol yicholotein, do everything in our ability. We have to make sure that Torah can flourish and can be built and take root on American soil. Not just the Tzibunan, the Dimiotan, the Komotan. In every measure, in every way possible, America cannot become a second-rate Torah locale. It has to become, it has to replicate what I just escaped from. And he says, "Bekad haaretz hazu has to settle over there. Mimena yitkonein kol beit Yisrael. Everybody has to be able to try kamosh yodea mishmei, and everybody has to do it. Why? And what's his justification for this?" So what he said. This is what comes to Rav Aaron Cutler's mind. His first thoughts in the United States. Ukmo sheyadua. So apparently he presumed that everybody knew this. If you do, it's well known, Mishmei, Da'agon, Reb Chaim, Mivul Lashon, what the founder of the great Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Vulajan had prophesied many years before, more than a century earlier, on the Diva, the Torah of the Eser HaMatzaniot, that Torah would have 10 stations in the exile. We'll enumerate, we'll recap exactly what those 10 are in a little bit. Ad Bo'o Sham Mashiach Tzidkenu, because we need that. Torah needs to be in America before Mashiach to come. Now the Rambam paskens that anybody, last two chapters in the Mishnah Torah, according to the Rambam, if anybody in this room, I don't know how politically able it would be, but if you were to build the Beit HaMikdash, you would be Mashiach. Anybody who builds the Beit HaMikdash, instantly it's proven, by virtue of the fact that they built a temple, that person is Mashiach. But in the theology of bringing about Yemot HaMashiach, bringing about a Messianic age, Rav Aaron Cutler held to this. This was one of the foundational stories. It became an Ikare Amuna. It became a foundation of his belief that Torah needed to settle in America. And Rav Aaron Cutler was not a young man, was not by all accounts an arrogant person, but he thought what? That he was the fulfillment, or at least part of the fulfillment, of the vision, the century-old vision, of Reb Chaim of Lashon. So what is this story? Let's take a look. I told you there was a second packet around there. I made sure that every row had a few. I have a digital copy, happy to, and I have to thank Rabbi Benzion Lozovsky for lending me his copy. In 1980, Yeshivas Brisk, well, they built or they renovated a building that at the time, fortunately not around anymore, but I'm told it was not too far away from where we sit this evening. But they produced a pamphlet to fundraise called An Epic of Torah Learning, the story of Yeshivas Brisk of Chicago. I'm not going to say what you think. In it is the reproduction. It's a fascinating tale, and for anybody who wants to see it, there are several pamphlets, about 12 or a dozen of them floating around. lf@htc.edu if you'd like a digital copy. But this was a story that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was quite fond of retelling, and I have photocopied the earliest, to my knowledge, printed version of Rav Aaron's retelling. So again, if you indulge me, and you flip it's the page with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. A transcript of remarks that he delivered at a principal's convention, a siyum, on behalf of Torah Umasora. Yeah, we don't have the time to read the entire thing, but it's available to you. It begins with a remarkable story, but really, at the bottom of that third column, or the first column on page 9, and he tells the story. He tells the story that at a Shavuot Shabbos, how does he know the story? Which is really remarkable when you think about it. How does he know the story is true? Why do I think that it's the most authentic version? It's because he heard it from his father, the Rav Aaron, from Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who heard it from his great-grand. It's mind-boggling that the relation is this close. But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik heard it at his bar mitzvah, from his father, Rav Moshe, who heard the story at his bar mitzvah in the 1890s. And the person who told the story at Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's bar mitzvah was the Netziv. The Netziv's was the great-grandfather of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who heard it from his father-in-law, who was Rav Itzel of Volozhiner, who was the son and attended a Shalosh Shudas Drasha. It's a reminder that Shalosh Shudas Torah is important. Of his father, Chaim of Volozhiner. So it was delivered, and apparently, as Rav Aaron tells it, is that Rav Chaim Volozhiner used to speak for an hour at Shalosh Shuvos, and that was when he got the machshava. That's when he got the theology of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and he tells the story why he cried. He actually cried twice, presumably. The story is actually even included in Making of a Gadol, which is quite fascinating. Good luck finding a copy. And he tells the story that he cried, but according to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, why did Rav Chaim Volozhiner cry when he recognized the Torah would have to traverse the Atlantic and settle in America? Look at the last paragraph. So it begins at the bottom of the third, but look at the fourth paragraph. This is Rav Aaron speaking, a transcript from 1975. He cried because so many, many Jews will have to go through such agony, and they will have to be able to gird themselves with courage. So maybe he understood the First Amendment. To gird themselves with courage and strength to face the challenge in order to transplant Torah on the American continent. Who knows how many Jews would be able to give up themselves to convert the American continent into a Torah center. So according to Rabbanan's retelling, it had nothing to do with the Shoah, nothing to do with the Holocaust, it had to do with non-observance and the challenges of living a religious lifestyle in the United States. Of course, that's less helpful to people like Rabbanan Cutler, who again, I don't think that he misunderstood. I think he had a different analysis of the story. But of course, the post-Holocaust resurgence of Torah is a little bit of a different story than the challenge and the weeping over the future non-observance of Jewish people in the United States, right? So it's actually, the story is, the pamphlet, the punchline of the pamphlet is that the story of Yeshivas Brisk is that they are the homecoming, so to speak, of Torah, because they are securing Torah in America so that Mashiach can come. Now, just to understand why this makes sense for Rav Chaim, this is really, really important. If you go back to the front page, this actually fits in quite well with Rav Chaim Volozhiner's worldview. His great opus was the Nefesh HaChaim. And in it, and probably the most famous of its four sections, is Shaar Dalet, his theology of Talmud Torah. That's where we understand Rav Chaim's vision for Torah Lishma, Torah for its own sake. And in it, he has a fabulous paragraph, and I've reproduced it for you in source 4, in which Rav Chaim Volozhiner supposes that from a temporal point of view, from the Nakuda of time, Torah needs to be studied at every moment along the eons of the world's existence. And if it were the case that Torah should not be studied for just a moment, if there was a moment in the history of the world in which somebody wasn't learning something to do with Torah, the entire universe would revert to Torah. That is the theology of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. You need Torah at all time to undergird, to be a scaffolding to the entire universe, and without Torah being uttered at every moment, the world would just collapse on itself. So it makes good sense. In fact, you see that in the language of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, that Torah, just like from a time, from a temporal perspective, from a spatial one as well, from the idea of geography, if Torah needs to be taught and learned at all times, then Torah needs to be at some point in every place. Well, now it's not just a nevuah according to Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Now, it is not merely, not simply, it's quite sophisticatedly part of his overall world view of a Torah mandate by Kudsha Baruch Hu for this world. And just like Torah needs to be stated and learned, uttered, remembered, recalled, thought of at all times, Torah needs to be in every place. And so in the early 19th century, Rav Chaim Volozhiner learned, you know what? That America, it's opening up. Well, if America is going to be viable, that must mean, according to my worldview, Torah needs to make it there. It needs to travel in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's retelling, the Kador Haaretz. He needs to travel the entire globe. Well then, it makes good sense that he should suppose that Torah would need to be in America in order for Mashiach to come. Now how did the yeshiva world use this story? So I reproduced for you many retellings. I'm going to turn the page to page two. After Rav Aaron Cutler used this as the foundational motif of his arrival in the United States in America in April 1941, he retold it many times over. And so, at the funeral, or at the shiva rather, at his son, Rav Shneur Cutler, Rav David Lifshitz, who of course for a short time was Rosh Yeshiva at the Hebrew Theological College, he used the story to describe Rav Aaron Cutler. And if you look in page at source six, this is actually from an audio recording of Mordechai Gifter in 1989. He used the story as well. Source six. This is in 1989, at a very heated, I think for Rav Gifter, many of his sichot were heated, but this one was particularly emotional. He said the following, and I produced the transcript, just slightly edited. Tells has tried to maintain its tradition, said Rabbi Gifter, as one of the great yeshivas from overseas. The yeshiva there was one of five great Torah centers in Lithuanian Jewry established in 1885. They did a wonderful job overseas, but Hitler brought about the job that had to be done in the United States. In some dastardly way, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, was a tool by God to bring Torah to America, according to Rav Gifter. I doubt whether he had any idea what his destruction of Jewry would lead to. I keep telling this story. He's obsessed. I keep telling this story. This is not the first occasion that Rav Gifter told it. Rav Chaim Volozhiner once burst out crying. The last station for Torah before the coming of Mashiach, I also use the transliteration that I thought Rav Gifter would have wanted me to, will be the United States of America. One of his great disciples asked him, this is Rabbi David Tavala, so why does Rebbe cry? They referred to in that, I don't know if that etiquette was around in that time, but in any case, what is there to cry about? His answer? I see how bitter it will be to create this last station. The traction, therefore, the story is becoming much, much more popular after Rav Aaron Cutler arrives in America. And if you look at Rav David Lifshitz in the earlier sources, it's the same thing. What is the purpose for the retelling of the story in the yeshiva world? What is Rav Gifter? What does Rav Aaron Cutler link it to? Any thoughts? It's always not America b'fnei atzma. It's not America to bring about the geula of Mashiach b'mehera b'yameinu. It's always to justify the yeshiva world coming from Europe to America. It is always perhaps to pardon or to justify why these yeshivot needed to move to America. These were, well, Rav Gifter was actually American born, European trained, however, that the earliest, the founding Rosh Yeshiva in the post-war period needed the story to authenticate their purpose, their missions in the United States. That's why it is part of the foundational story. If you take a look, it has a little 7. It is a page out of the Jewish Observer. Much of Jewish history is trapped in the pages of the Good Israel Jewish Observer. This is a speech delivered at a Good Israel convention in 1979, reproduced in the Jewish Observer by Ruth Ruderman, who's Rosh Yeshiva Bnei Yisrael in Baltimore. In his remarks, he says, and I have, it is, I'm in the penultimate, the second to last paragraph, it was not from the vantage of prophecy but out of recognition of this pattern that Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner carefully predicted at the laying of the cornerstone of his, I guess we're from Chicago, we can just suppose that he said Yeshiva, in Volozhin in 1803, this will not be the final station of Torah before Mashiach. Torah is yet to flourish in the wilds of the American continent before he, that being Mashiach, can come. It's fascinating. In Rav Ruderman's recounting, when does Rav Chaim say, not at Shal Shudas, but in some sort of building dedication at the fortification of the very cornerstone in the beginning of the outset of the 19th century, Reb Chaim, the architect of the yeshiva educational movement, lays the cornerstone of his famed yeshiva, which he has spent a lifetime and discussed with his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, to architect, to construct. He's crying at that moment, saying, purpose of my yeshiva is to set in motion a series of events which will lead to Torah's migration in the United States. In this way, the purpose of the Volozhiner yeshiva, primarily at the cornerstone at that ceremony, wasn't about producing a Rav Kook, a Beis Halevi and a Tziv. In this retelling, the purpose of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Volozhin is to bring Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Ruderman and Rav Gifter and Rav Huttner and maybe Rabbi Soloveitchik, two of them, to the United States. That's the raison d'etre of the entire institution. And if you look, when I talk about the foundational myth and culture, one final source, go back to the very beginning, the third page in this packet has a little number 3. Sure enough, in the preface of actually very well constructed and accurate coffee table, but very educational books produced by, I believe, the Hebrew Academy of Cleveland, operate a very important institution, and they've produced many pamphlets and even some very important books. And in the very preface, in the series called The World That Was, but their volume on America, a pretty nifty tome, they begin, it was approximately 200 years ago when the Vilna Gaon's primary disciple, Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, who at the time was laying the cornerstone, so they picked up on Rav Ruderman's story, for his preeminent yeshiva in Volozhin, called attention to the potential sanctuary for Torah, so they softened it just a little bit, that lay across the ocean. This haven, for Jewry would be the last stop in their exile. Rabbi Chaim shed tears that were mistaken as tears of joy, okay? A little bit of drama added, but were really tears of grief. No, said Rabbi Chaim, I cry out of sadness. Were Volozhin to be the last station for Torah's wanderings before the advent of Mashiach, I would cry for joy. Unfortunately, the Torah is destined to wander further to the wilds, so using Rav Ruderman's language quite precisely, of America before Mashiach Tzidkenu arrives, and who can tell how many thousands of Jews will be lost to our people in America. So it sits. If whether the story or not was told at the cornerstone laying of the yeshiva in Volozhin in 1802, 1803, the cornerstone of the yeshiva world has been this very important and incredibly culturally freighted story, this narrative that the purpose of Europe was to produce in America, therefore Aaron Cutler and Rav Ruderman and Rav Gifter and all of the people that we've studied, however briefly this evening, they were all destined, bal karcha, against their will, to arrive in the United States, and just like the establishment and the massive, truly, harbatzar Torah that they produced in the United States. But its original purpose, perhaps, just breath, it's wandered just a bit. Because in the original telling of Ramana Sambhaji in his mission-driven system, which I believe he felt in his guts, that when his time in YU, his time at Skokie Yeshiva, his time at Brisk was all meant, was all predetermined, and to help fulfill a mandate to bring not just Torah to America, but for Yemot HaMashiach, for Aaron Soloveitchik. This wasn't just a foundational myth for Torah in the United States. This was a vision, a Torah vision of how to bring Mashiach. The envy that I have for Aaron, and just the amount of admiration that I have for Aaron Soloveitchik, that he lived every single day of his life, that every moment in which he taught Torah in America was somehow anchored to this vision, that every single time he taught some Torah from his grandfather, Reb Chaim, he was one step closer to bringing Yemot HaMashiach. In this way, this story might be reclaimed, if it isn't already so, as part of a religious Zionist vision. How fitting it is that we can tie our Torah to our belief in our dream and our great hope, to use our Zionism, however we do it, through our philanthropy, through our tefillot, through our politics, whatever it is you, however it is you manifest your Zionism, your religious Zionism, the reason why we're here this evening, to wed it to Torah. That I can't think of is anything more unadulterated, any more pronounced, any more pristine, is a truly magnificent vision, not just for Torah in America, for the institutions that we support, but for how we might bring Mashiach in the Caribbean. Thank you so much.